Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of June 25th, 2016. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. Hello, D.R. Tucker. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you doing? Can you believe June's almost over?
Oh, my God. It is distressing to realize how time flies, I tell you. It just seems like it was January 5 minutes ago. Mm-hmm. Anyway, DR, this has been a busy week in here in the great state of Massachusetts, climate leading state in the union. But last week, a couple weeks ago, we reported how the mayor of Boston had flown over to Beijing, China, to participate in a international conference on the participation of cities in addressing global warming. Blah 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 blah. Lots of good stuff happens. There was a report that came out this week, or actually just recently, that said had fairly sobering, if not to say dire, warnings for the city of Boston. Right? Did you see anything about that?
Yes, it was a report from the University of Massachusetts that said that, in the worst, according to the Globe, the consequences of climate change in Boston could be far worse than previously expected, and that in the worst case scenario, sea level rise could hit more than 10 feet by the end of the century and would put 30% of Boston underwater, and temperatures in 2070 could exceed 90 degrees for 90 days a year, and there could also be a 50% decline in annual snowfall. So basically, you know, Boston no more, basically.
90 days a year of more than 90 degree weather. So if I do my arithmetic right, that's basically June, July, and August would be over 90 degrees continuously, right? Yes. That exactly. Is not a and I agree. One of the real findings was that the sea level rise thing. What they were saying was that the east coast of the United States, of which Boston is, of course, sitting on the east coast of the U.S., is particularly susceptible because the land itself is subsiding, and as the Antarctic melts, somehow, I guess I don't fully understand it, but the gravitational pull of the water will increase the amount of water in the North Atlantic. And that, of course, directly affects the sea level here. And that basically they said, you know, if a 5 foot sea level, a 5 foot flood would be up around Faneuil Hall. So yes. Those of you who are familiar with Boston, there's a big, downtown Boston. Faneuil Hall is 200-year-old place where Thomas Jefferson and all those famous guys spoke. But it's right in kind of the business and entertainment district down there. And that would be underwater in this circumstance, right? 100 years from now, it would be underwater, which is really weird.
As well as Copley Square would also be underwater in this worst-case scenario.
Copley Square is where Trinity Church and the Boston Public Library is, right? Mm-hmm. And South Station, not South Station, whatever the train station is, the Copley Station, the Back Bay Station, right? That would all be underwater. I mean, that's a tough thing to imagine.
And it goes to show you why, you know, people have to sort of press their legislators to sort of do something about this, that it just goes to show you that we need to be flooded with some clean energy to avoid being flooded
by salt water. Exactly. Well, yeah, I mean, it's not a joke, but we've talked in the show before about how the tax records for Boston are kept in the basement of City Hall, which, of course, is just about at the same location as Faneuil Hall, right? So, exactly. But the idea of moving the tax records out of City Hall seems kind of paltry when the water's edge is going to be at the front step of City Hall, right?
Exactly. Ironically, that we will need a carbon tax to avoid the tax records being flooded out.
That's right. We could keep for some people want all those tax records in the basement. Well, I think it's. I mean, we joke, as Bill Maher would say. I joke, but in fact, this is a fairly serious report. I guess we will see some discussion about it next next July, this time next year, when all of the cities of the world have the next conference on global warming and cities here in Boston sometime in 2017.
Exactly.
So given the fact that downtown Boston is going to be underwater in the not-too-distant future, our Attorney General, Maura Healey, who was elected now two years ago, is participating in this, or is investigating ExxonMobil for fraud, right? Isn't she? So what's gone on there?
Well, there was a great report by Inside Climate News explaining the unusual aggression by ExxonMobil to sort of push back against Maura Healey's efforts to investigate the company for its potential deception and its potential sort of chicanery in terms of what it disclosed and what it did not disclose to its shareholders. Inside Climate News noted that several days ago, ExxonMobil filed a complaint in federal court in Texas and in Suffolk Superior Court in Boston, trying to have Maura Healey's subpoena thrown out. Maura Healey subpoenaed Exxon's offices, I believe in Massachusetts, for records going back to 1976 to determine what did Exxon tell its shareholders and what did Exxon tell the public. Exxon is trying to essentially assert corporate free speech rights and trying to claim that Maura Healey doesn't have the legal authority to sort of execute this subpoena. In addition to this, Inside Climate News also noted that a series of attorneys general from states that are challenging the Clean Power Plan in court sent a letter to Healey, Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, and other attorneys general that are looking at Exxon, basically accusing them of launching a witch hunt and suggesting that they, in turn, might start legally harassing clean energy companies in their states if Healey and Schneiderman and other attorneys general continue with their investigation of Exxon. So
you mean as retribution?
Essentially as retribution, to basically send a blizzard of subpoenas around. But it does raise the question of what is ExxonMobil exactly trying to hide? And number two, in the news coverage, the Exxon PR flack keeps on saying that it's wrong for Maura Healey to go after Exxon when Exxon has, you know, spent so much money on climate research and publicly supports a carbon tax. Well, again, that's all nice and good that they spent money on climate research and supports a carbon tax. But if they committed fraud, they still have to be investigated.
Well, tell me, you raise an interesting point, though. If I, as an individual, if the Attorney General thinks that I have, I don't know, defrauded, maybe I'm running a huckster scheme, right? I'm a confidence man. And they subpoenaed all of my tax records back to 1976. Is that legal? Is that commonplace? Or is it different for a corporation that has responsibility to maintain records and things that an individual doesn't?
I believe it's different for corporations. Essentially, as Inside Climate News suggests, there are statutes in Massachusetts similar to the statute that Eric Schneiderman is using to try to get the records from Exxon. Inside Climate News reports that, quote, in its lawsuit, Exxon said the Massachusetts investigation under consumer and securities fraud statutes is, quote, nothing more than a weak pretext for an unlawful exercise of government power, unquote. Well, now, wait a minute. What about the potential unlawful exercise of Exxon's power if, in fact, they deceived shareholders about the value of its product, a product that would have to be discouraged from use if what their scientific evidence was pointing to was accurate, which we know it was?
I guess it is the analogy to the tobacco industry, I think, is the real one, right? Now, I don't know. I don't remember if the Attorney General's demanded documents from the tobacco industry. But it seems to me like a stretch of First Amendment rights for a company like Exxon to whine, shall we say, about the denial of their free speech rights and the accusations. I don't know. This is ongoing interplay of the unholy alliance of Exxon and 13 red state attorneys general who are trying to intimidate in reverse, right? Everyone accuses everyone else of being intimidating. They're out there trying to stop the good guys in the white hats, right? Like Maura Healey, who's trying to find out what Exxon knew and when it knew it.
Exactly. And it's also interesting that Exxon also asserts that the statute of limitations has run out in terms of the law that Maura Healey is citing. I didn't know there was a statute of limitations on fraud.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Maybe it's well, I think that, you know, these guys who run corporations, they may think that they're people, but it seems like there's a lot more specific regulation when you're buying and selling and mm-hmm. have stockholders. And you got to be a lot more conscientious in your record keeping. Well, we will keep an eye on that. I mean, Attorney General Healey is still marching along, doing the right thing there. So, mm-hmm. tell me, there's at the same time as all this is going on up in West Roxbury, the suburb of Boston, right down there on the Jamaica Way, VFW Parkway, West Roxbury. There's been lots and lots going on there. Mm-hmm. In fact, just today, I think, yesterday and today, there were more protests at the pipeline there. So let me just remind everyone, West Roxbury is a suburb of Boston. Spectra Energy, who's trying to build a pipeline through Massachusetts, is trying to put a 16-inch pipeline down the middle of a very busy street in a very dense neighborhood, mm-hmm. and has met serious opposition from the people who live in West Roxbury, opposition, yes. to the point of frequent, if not daily, protests and frequent mm-hmm. arrests, right?
Exactly. And in this most recent demonstration on June the 23rd, 26 demonstrators were arrested and 6 people were released on site without being arrested. They are consistent and they are determined, and they are basically making it very, very clear that Spectra Energy should know where they can stick that pipeline.
I think the scene, we'll put up a link to it, but I think the scene is that you've got this backhoe digging a trench down the middle of, I think it's Grove Street, right, is where mm-hmm. they refer to, but it's a fairly busy street in West Roxbury. Backhoe digging a trench down the middle of the street, and these people go up and they sit at the edge of the hole mm-hmm. and put their feet in and just sit there and wait for the police to come. I guess mm-hmm. the police are rather gentle about the whole thing, right? Because a lot yeah. of the police live there in West Roxbury. It's exactly. A lot of them. I mean, it's a tough position to put them in. But the mm-hmm. whole thing, I guess, is proceeding with decorum and civility, right? And it's not exactly. Interesting. Interesting.
And you can make an argument that these protesters are police in a way, because they're engaging in an enforcement of moral law.
Yep. The analogy is there. You know, so we send our congratulations to people in West Roxbury to keep up the good work. I mean, it's impressive. We had a show a few weeks ago of one of the leaders, Chuck Collins. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll add that to the list of links. But it's an impressive effort up there. But at the same time, now, I heard the both Senators Warren and Markey sent a, what I would call a nasty gram, a letter to the an organization called FERC, the Federal mm-hmm. Energy Resource Commission, right?
Yeah, Federal Energy Regulatory Commission.
Regulatory Commission. And what did they say?
Yes, they sent a letter, Senators Warren and Markey sent a letter to the head of the FERC urging the cancellation of an environmental impact statement, environmental impact assessment of the Spectra Atlantic Bridge Project pipeline, which goes through Massachusetts, mm-hmm. after a revelation by the website desmogblog.com revealed that the entity, which I believe is known as the Natural Resource Group, that was hired to do the environmental assessment, the environmental impact statement by FERC, has long-standing ties to Spectra, which is a blatant conflict of interest. Warren and Markey asked the head of the FERC if Natural Resource Group disclosed its ties to Spectra before they got the gig to mm-hmm. do the environmental assessment. It's unclear at this time whether or not FERC has responded. And it just goes to show you this issue of industry capture and how sort of the sort of incestuous relationship between the fracked gas industry and the FERC and contractors hired by the FERC. DeSmog Blog noted that I guess there was a hearing in Massachusetts in which representatives from the and the Natural Resource Group were essentially presented to the public as representatives of the FERC, even though they worked for an FERC, essentially a contractor hired by the FERC. So it just goes to show you this sort of nasty, nasty relationship and the urgent need for reform of the FERC. And you do wonder if this will be a political issue in the election this fall, you know, because when people talk about, you know, the demand for, you know, clean energy and demand for serious action on climate change, how are you going to have serious action if the FERC does not undergo top to bottom, stem to stern reform? I mean, it desperately needs to be sort of cleaned up. It has all these sort of,
my understanding is the FERC was formed sometime in the mid 70s to help facilitate the construction of energy projects in the United States. So this harkens back to a time when we were all afraid of the Saudis and they were going to turn off the gasoline, the oil scares of the 70s. Mm-hmm. But as you quite rightly say, FERC, it would appear, has become too cozy with the industry. And now they're kind of this rubber stamp, and they don't really have the interest. Certainly they don't have – they may claim to, but I don't think they really have a climate angle on what they're doing. I don't think they see that, right? Their job is to get oil and gas pipelines built and get things through the regulation, the thicket of regulation. And I hope that the letter from Senators Warren and Markey have an impact there. We'll see, right? We'll have to keep an eye on. One more thing to keep an eye on. There's way too many things to watch. Mm-hmm. So I guess we would be remiss to in this week, you and I have skipped a week. We didn't talk last week. Over the last 2 weeks, there have been really profound and sad things happening in the United States. And without rehearsing the whole thing over again, the terrible tragedy down in Orlando, I mean, the mind-bendingly sad thing that goes on there with all the attendant politics. And then, of course, just recently, members of the U.S. House of Representatives taking what can only be described as an extraordinary step of having a sit-in, an old-fashioned kind of sit-in in the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives, which really, I mean, it takes some moxie. I guess so these things have to do with gun regulations. They have to do with, you know, basic, you know, fundamental politics. I guess the question is, what kinds of lessons should climate hawks take from this, right? When you look at this from a climate perspective, what do you see? I mean, you just had 26 people arrested in the sitting with their legs dangling into a pipeline hole up in West Roxbury in an act of civil disobedience, and you had equal numbers of U.S. congresspersons sitting on the floor of the House of Representatives. Is there a tie there? Is there any connection?
Well, there was an interesting point made by Desi Doyen in a recent edition of the Brad Friedman broadcast discussing this, where she noted that, number one, it shows you the power of civil disobedience, that we've talked before about the legacy of civil disobedience and how it's been picked up by the climate movement. And now the power of civil disobedience is now being demonstrated literally on the floor of Capitol Hill. And number two, she also noted that this is, you know, when John Lewis and Representative Catherine Clark made the statement that they would occupy the House floor, that it was echoing back to the Occupy movement. And remember what Naomi Klein said about the Occupy movement and how it basically led to the anti-Keystone XL movement. Mm-hmm. So it basically is a testament to the power of civil disobedience and the power of, again, enforcing moral law. And obviously it's something that climate hawks should study, because obviously, you know, the same forces, the same financial and ideological forces aligned against taking action on guns, those are very similar ideological and financial forces aligned against action on carbon pollution. And who knows, we might have to have another sit-in to sort of force the House to consider a carbon tax bill.
Well, I mean, all that stuff comes to mind, right? I mean, I guess the thing, one of the things I would take out of it is how, and we've touched on this topic before as well, but that how quickly public opinion can shift, right? Mm-hmm. And there's, I think, for a long time, a public opinion on common sense gun stuff, right, has been gathering since the terribleness in San Bernardino and all this. But all of a sudden, it solidifies, and if you're there and can take advantage of it, that's a good thing. And I think the people in the House of Representatives are trying to bottle the lightning there, right, and do something with it. I think climate hawks are in the same kind of preparatory thing. We are doing stuff now, and it's not clear what the trigger will be and how what will shift the thought process. But you could easily imagine a circumstance where all of a sudden it becomes very important for to take action on climate, and we have to be ready for that moment.
And to your point, you know, notice how many climate hawks were involved in this sit-in protest. I can think of two, Congressman Jared Huffman of California and Congressman Ted Deutch of Florida. Ted Deutch, who literally 24 hours before the sit-in began, was honored by the group Citizens Climate Lobby for his work to secure bipartisan support for action to reduce carbon pollution. So it just goes to show you again the sort of the similarities between the two issues and how, in many respects, advocates of reducing carbon pollution and advocates of reducing gun violence are fighting a common enemy.
And I think that the recognition, right, the common enemy and the common sort of the common underlying goals of kind of a reasonable, open, just society, right, that unites climate hawks with you know, LGBT. You know, the people in Orlando and the people against. I mean, there's this whole raft of things that should be sort of have more in common than they have to separate them. And the sooner we recognize that, the better off we are.
Exactly. I mean, seriously, as I watched this, I had flashbacks to all the Keystone XL pipeline protests and how you saw sit-ins and people getting you know, tying themselves to the White House.
And you just
see this movement, because basically it goes to something that Bill McKibben has talked about and Wayne Stevenson has talked about and Naomi Klein has talked about, how you have to use a different form of currency if you're being outspent by ideological adversaries. You have to use the currency of your voice. You have to use the currency of your body. You have to use the currency of your vote. You have to use a different sort of currency to outspend those who use financial currency to sort of block what you want.
Well, there you go, DR. You have the last word. I think that's well spoken. So what we'll do, we covered a lot of ground tonight. What we'll try and do is put up links to most of what we talked about on the blog. It'll be at massclimateaction.net/blog. When you go to the blog, let me just tell you, there are two events coming up that MCAN is sponsoring, and you can sign up for them. You have to go to the blog and RSVP, but on July 14th, MCAN and the Sierra Club will be co-sponsoring a movie night downtown at Atlantic Wharf, and you should go check that out. And on July 20th, is a Wednesday morning, I believe, we're sponsoring a tour to Deer Island to look at the wind turbines, the solar panels, the anaerobic digesters, and basically look out at gorgeous Boston Harbor from Deer Island. So if anybody wants to sign up for that, go to the MCAN website. Again, it's what I just said, massclimateaction.net, and go to the events page, and you can RSVP. So I encourage everyone to do that. So let me go back and continue. You can find us on Facebook at /massclimateaction. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher or TuneIn Radio. You can find us on iTunes, of course. So, DR, we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. So, DR, as always, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks.
And thanks to everyone for listening. We really and truly appreciate it. We'll talk to you again real soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.